Excellent. And let's have a big hand for Scott and the entire EFF team. This is one of the most amazing and informative tracks at Dragon Con. Check out all their sessions. Well, the ones I do, but all the sessions are incredibly valuable. Hello, I am Andrew Greenberg. I serve in a lot of different roles. For this panel, I'll discuss being executive director of the Georgia Game Developers Association, which works in the public sphere and works on policy a lot more than you might have otherwise expected. I'm also the chairman of the DeKalb County Entertainment Commission. How many of you are Georgians or know what DeKalb County is? All right. Excellent. So building up the film, gaming, and music industry there. Serve on the State Film, Music, and Digital Entertainment Commission as a gubernatorial appointee. Serve in economic development boards and workforce boards and so forth. And before I turn it over to the rest of our panelists to introduce themselves, I'd like to have you introduce yourselves, not one at a time. How many of you work in public policy in some form right now? Excellent. How many of you would like to work in public policy at some point? Excellent. So there will be a good discussion here on pathways in.
How,
that's right. How many do it on a too often unpaid basis? All hands on the panel up.
Yeah.
Excellent. All right. So I'm going to have all the panelists introduce themselves, talk a little bit how they got into public policy. On my end, it's a long track from writing about lawyers when I was a reporter to writing about vampires when I became a game designer to using that to build up the game industry here in Georgia. Started a convention called Siege on Game Development in our 13th year in October. Yes, some attendees here for that. October 13th to 15th, all about game development. But had to become very active in the political spectrum because games are attacked. But games also have unique opportunities in public sphere, and education is a core part of what we have to do. So with that, I will turn it to my left.
You want to start in the end and come down? I don't want to take up too much time. So.
You're going to take up the same amount of time either way.
Well, no, at the end of the day, dense what I say based on how long other people talk.
Okay, then. I'm Meredith Rose. I work for a group called Public Knowledge. We are a consumer advocacy group in Washington, D.C. We work on the national level on tech policy with a consumer focus writ large. So that's everything from copyright, which is primarily my beat, all the way down to net neutrality, to privacy, to spectrum auctions at the FCC. If you really want to walk out, I'm not the person to do it with. That's my colleague, Harold. Trademarks, free speech online, platform governance, you name it.
Hi, my name is Carl Grindel, a PhD student at the Georgia Institute of Technology, where I research cybersecurity policy issues in the School of Public Policy. Before I moved down to Georgia, was in D.C. doing cybersecurity consulting. I decided that I was interested in policy when I deleted my laptop, installed Linux, and then was confused why my professors in college wouldn't accept my files in .odt format. And have been basically in the policy space for the decade since.
Hey everyone, I'm Eric Portnoy. I'm a technologist at the Electronic Frontiers Foundation. I work on CertBot, which is EFF's Let's Encrypt client, helping people to get certificates for their websites to turn on HTTPS. I also do a bunch of our crypto policy work. I came into this space because I started off as a computer scientist. You know, I was doing software engineering, like, and then I would start to work on things like cryptography and messaging applications, and I had this great idea. I was like, oh, I was all set to like go and do a PhD in cryptography. I'll just invent the next cryptography, and then people will have access to and control over their data, but it'll be encrypted on the server, and I'll go into industry and try to implement this. And I realized, oh, no, it's not that we need new technologies around this thing. It's that people are just refusing to implement the good privacy-protecting technologies that already exist. And so, you know, what's the point of inventing the next big thing if nobody will implement the technology that we currently have that is there to be protective of people's rights? And so I moved into the policy space.
My name is Amy Stepanovich. As of 4.5 weeks ago, I'm the executive director of Silicon Flatirons, which is the tech policy center at Colorado Law School. I've been doing public policy since 2009, so 10 years. I came from Okeechobee, Florida. I don't know if any of you know where that is. Yeah, middle of nowhere. Not somebody you would think would end up in DC for 10 years doing policy. I moved to Colorado, to Boulder very recently. Really kind of fell backward into this, thought about doing journalism and then advertising, and decided that I really loved technology, and made my way through a really weird, windy road into tech policy. And one of the goals that I have at the law school is actually to try to better diversify the public policy space, because one of the things I learned working in DC is there are a lot of people working on issues that have never affected them. I don't know if any of you grew up or currently don't have high-speed internet. Anybody? No? Well, so that high speed, like, internet access is a big issue in DC right now. My mother's house still doesn't have high-speed internet, and I would be in these conversations with people, and they had never experienced in their adult technical lives not having access to that sort of technology, and it was a really weird experience for me being the only person in those rooms who had had that experience. So I'm trying to get it. I come from a place where I'm trying to get more different experiences in the policy room.
Hi, my name is Nathan White. I too have had a long, winding road of doing things that interest me, and I guess you call that a career after a while. I was fortunate enough to start my career working for Congress in 2008. I got a join right before Wall Street crashed. So I got to work on a lot of fun stuff. Like, I was on an oversight committee investigating the Wall Street bailout. I got to work on Obamacare. And yeah, lots of exciting things happened back then. But what was most exciting for me was the lack of knowledge around tech policy and the lack of tech policy being a thing. Did a lot of work on SOPA PIPA, explaining how to use technology to members of Congress. When I left Congress, I started a consulting company to use technology to win elections and win policy battles. Did that for several years until I joined Amy at Access Now, where I was something like a public interest lobbyist. Just made that term up. Lobbyist isn't a very specific legal definition, but it's really hard to understand what people do in DC if you don't actually work in that. So public interest lobbyist, sure, we'll go with that. And now I work for Facebook, working on privacy policies and platform policies for emerging technologies, including augmented reality and virtual reality.
Excellent. So I do like to have these as interactive panels. Obviously, there's a lot of interest here in getting into the public policy sphere. We have the box in the back. We're not going to listen to you unless you're talking to the box. That way we're recording what you say, and we'll be able to remind you to rate this on this session in your on your app. Sorry, I'll do that a bunch of times since Scott was telling me to do it. But we'll go ahead and get the ball rolling here first and get our panelists to talk. First of all, before we get into the winding route, let's start with some of the benefits of working in public policy. Specifically, what are some of the wins? What are the things you're proud of? What are you glad that you've been able to achieve? So I'll give one example for myself. Here in Georgia, we've had a shortage of computer science, kids studying computer science in junior high and high school. It's been a massive problem for a long time. We thought it was a tech issue, so we started working on trying to supply technology. One of the things we then discovered was that it looked like the main problem was that students just didn't have a place in their high school schedule to take any computer science, because computer science only counted as a business elective. So when you're filling out your entire schedule of all the things you have to take to graduate, for 90% of the students, there is no place for it in their planning. They're planning from eighth grade on. They just can't do it. So a bill we actually had to get through the legislature, the GGDA started this, the Technology Association of Georgia became our big partner on it, was to expand the number of things that a computer science could count towards, science elective, math elective, et cetera. And now we are seeing computer science education expand. I'm very proud of that.
Anything you're proud of? Or anything good about working in public policy you want to share?
So I have a fun anecdote.
We'll go back to you last.
Yeah, so I spend a lot of my day job talking about copyright and music licensing, which is a total snooze fest unless you want to listen to a crazed woman yell about it for 2 hours, and that's what I get paid to do. Last year, there was a bill. There were a handful of bills moving through Congress, which were ultimately condensed into this thing called the Music Modernization Act. And that was going to do a bunch of stuff to the structure of music licensing and copyright in the United States, some of which were great, some of which were really, really not. The universe of music licensing and people who work on it is even smaller than the universe of people who actually understand it, because it is such a niche field, and the overwhelming majority of people who work on it are industry affiliated. So there are people who work for the Recording Industry Association of America, the RIAA. we fought part of this bill because what it was going to do was going to take old sound recordings made prior to 1976, and especially recordings made before, like the early recordings prior to like 1930, and it was going to lock them away under copyright until 2067. And so we fought about this. There really weren't any other groups that had anything close to bandwidth to deal with this issue. It was basically just us and, like, for a little while, the library associations were fighting on it. I had the head of the RIAA call me up at my desk and just cold call me and is like, "You're wrong." And I was like, "Hello, who is this?" And he's like, "I'm blah, blah, blah with the RIAA." And I was like, "Oh, hello, okay. Let me kick the intern out of my office so we can have this conversation." And we ended up getting the bill changed. We actually, you know, it was really just, it was a rare moment where it was actually just a scrappy team of like three or four public interest advocates managed to stand up against the combined weight of the RIAA and the National Music Publishers Association. We got one friendly ear in the Senate, and that was enough leverage to actually fix the bill. So it can happen. Like, you actually do occasionally have David and Goliath moments where you can stop a bad idea in its tracks. Now, they're not as frequent as they should be. I will say that unabashedly. But I think, you know, you actually, it is, as a little guy, you can, you know, if you manage to get the stars to align and you are, you know, I want to say if you're smart about it, but I was flying by the seat of my pants, so I'm not going to say that. You know, you can actually make a difference.
Here.
I like to say working in public policy when you really care about the issues is like drinking out of a fire hose and asking for more water. There are always 50,000 things to work on, and you're always saying yes to more things. People have a really hard time saying no in this space. Nathan was the person who worked with me and always told me no. And it was a really important thing in my life. When we knew we couldn't work on more. One of the good things that I'll talk about before I'll turn the microphone over. Anybody heard of the name Edward Snowden? Maybe. So I worked on surveillance for several years, surveillance issues several years before Edward Snowden became a thing. And then all of a sudden, my family knew what I did for a living. Before they were like, "Oh, you work on like stuff with Facebook, right?" Sorry, that's just what they knew. I was like, "Sure, we'll go with that." And then they knew, and everybody else kind of knew as well, and it was really amazing. And by working in coalition, and I think the coalition aspect of policy work cannot be understated, because I think you have, sometimes you are the only group working on things, but more often you have those David and Goliath moments when you have 10 groups that are able to talk with the same voice. And by working in coalition, we were able to get the very first surveillance reform in the U.S. passed at the federal level in several decades. We were able to shut down one of the NSA's programs that many people said was unlawful and get some significant reforms for that. And we'll figure out in December, because the reform and the law that it modified is set to sunset this year, what happens with that next. Unfortunately, and this is the other side of public policy, is that wins are few and far between, so you have to really care. And you have to want to work on things, and you have to be willing to celebrate really small, teeny tiny wins as if they were like giant. Because some of the things that we were able to get and some of the reforms we were able to see, we're now watching them get rolled back and undermined. And that is one of the more frustrating things, I will say, about the job. I didn't really think going into this, you think you have a win and you move on and you work on something else, and sometimes those can actually get erased. And that's to positive and negative.
I worked for Congress on a bill to repeal the Patriot Act, and one of the things I was grateful for Snowden was finally my parents didn't think I was paranoid anymore. that was kind of a nice win.
Take that, Mom.
If only she knew I was listening to her phone message when she was saying that. No, I'm kidding. It's hard to say, because the things that are the biggest wins are also some of the biggest challenges. And you said that with drinking from the fire hose of everything we get to work on is really exciting, but it's also really, really hard, and there's lots of it, and it's always coming. And it makes it really difficult to decide when you're going to stop working. Like, how do you say, "I'm done enough work today on this bill that is going to impact millions of people's lives"? How am I able to say, "Well, now I want to go have a drink and have a nice dinner"? when I'm dealing with healthcare for people who are going to get it taken away. So there's a lot of drive to continue doing things and a lot of self-sacrifice. And that also sometimes makes the career a little difficult, because a lot of times, especially when you're breaking in, there are people who will take advantage of your desire to work relatively cheaply or for free. On the flip side, there's a lot of people who are really into public service and come from families of wealth where it's really just not about the money. That is not a factor. In DC, you see it a lot where somebody will, in one side of a marriage, will work on public policy, and the other side of the marriage will work for a corporate lawyer. And so there's challenges of, I always want to keep working and I always want to do interesting things, and that is the best part about it. But it also never really ends, and you can never really meet all of the demand. So there's some emotional stress there as well. And for the small victories, you also have to continue to defend those small victories. We won that surveillance bill, what, 2015? And now here we are again, like still, like, NSA has said they don't even need this program. It doesn't work very well. It's expensive. Let's shut it down. And we still have to fight over it. I left the intervention yesterday because I was texting her things like, oh, you should bring up, and then she starts talking about it. We've been talking about encryption forever, and it is a battle that if we ever give up, we will lose, and we have to keep fighting. So that's one of the areas where it's a little bit annoying, but compared to any other area of public policy, tech policy is absolutely the best because it's constantly new and it's constantly emerging. If you work on things like health policy or really any kind of policy, you're rehashing the same arguments that people have been having for decades. I'm going to make argument A, you're going to counter with argument B, I'm going to say argument C, the audience is going to think we're all joking, and then we're going to end up at E. Like, you can just predict where these things are going. But tech policy, it's all brand new. No one's ever seen this before. No one really knows what they're doing. So we're collecting the evidence, we're trying to build the arguments, and that makes it constantly exciting. So, pros and cons.
Yeah, actually, so one of the ways I heard it phrased is that we are, in tech policy, we're in the vocabulary building stage of how we even talk about some of these issues. So, like, privacy. I worked very briefly on privacy, and then I ran away like my ass was on fire. Because I, no thank you. That's the fire hose that I cannot drink from. So one of the early conversations around... It's not an early conversation around privacy and tech policy. This conversation in tech policy has been going on for a long time. Groups started getting pulled into it. Like my organization, we didn't do privacy up until about 2015, 2016. The FCC, after the net neutrality decision, the good one, not the current one, all of a sudden realized they had a mandate under the law to implement privacy rules about what Title II carriers, which was ISPs, could do with the data that they have to collect by virtue of being common carriers. And all of a sudden, we had to care about privacy. And it has been fascinating to watch groups that are new to this and groups that have been around for a long time try to synthesize the different angles that they come at and to start develop the vocabulary. What do we really care about when we talk about privacy? Everyone's got privacy is super idiosyncratic. Like everyone's got a slightly different iteration of what they would define it as, especially if you're a layperson. Forget even getting in front of a judge and trying to get the judge to agree with you on what that means. But it's a fascinating time because we're starting to talk about that. We're talking about antitrust things in platforms. We're talking, like, what are competitive harms? What about vertical integration? Courts have not been able to deal with that particularly well for years. And so it's a super active and dynamic time right now because, like Nathan said, like, this is a matter of first impression over and over again.
I'll just say that kind of on the academic side, things are moving so fast in the public policy lobbying arena that I think oftentimes there's not the time to slow down and ask certain questions about, like, what exactly happened and how can we frame it in a way that people understand and make sense of it. So I think, like, back to the sort of question of accomplishments, one of the projects I got to work on was a history book on DoD cybersecurity strategy dating back to 1986. And you can look back at the hacks that Clifford Stoll was dealing with back in 1986 and see parallels with what happens in this decade and like draw from historical lessons to help sort of blend that vocabulary in a way and make sense of the world that hopefully then helps these people with their work.
All right. So I think we've seen a lot of the fun that is public policy, and it is constantly exciting. And one of the great things is there are always new challenges to solve. If you like problem solving, this is a place for you. So let's talk a little bit more about the path in and the skills required. And I'll touch a little bit on my own path. I started as a reporter. You've heard a lot of people talking about D.C. I was a reporter on Capitol Hill in D.C. back in 1990. First got my taste of dealing with politicians, the courts, and the regulatory groups then. Stepped out of it to do games for a long, long time, and stepped back in when I felt the game industry was under threat. I worked with the IGDA's anti-censorship group fighting against attempts to create censorship on video games, and then in building the association here. And I think journalism is a great path in because you get a chance to look at issues, you see what matters to you, and you see where you can be a part of the solution. But it also teaches you to communicate effectively. It teaches you to ask a lot of questions, and it teaches you to get things done on deadline, which are three amazingly valuable skills in the public policy sphere. So I'm going to turn it over to whoever wants to jump on it next to talk about your own path on in and what skills you think that gave you along the way.
I've been thinking about this one, so this one I have a bit of an answer prepared. Not everybody should go work for Congress, but Congress was a really great place for me to start because I learned a couple of things. First of all, really, the decision makers have no idea what they're doing. Like, they are just making stuff up as they go along. Details, they hire people to deal with details. The people who do with the details are usually...
wish they hired people.
If they do. Their staffers are pretty young. They don't have specific education in the areas they're working on. They're really making it up as you go along. So there is not some, like, law school or source that dines on you like you are now a public policy expert. Literally, public policy experts are people who just pay attention to something over time, have opinions, and are ready to be wrong. That after a few years of working at Congress, I realized I know more about tech policy than almost anybody here. That's a problem we should solve because I shouldn't be doing this. That years we've been talking about net neutrality. I don't have any specific education in net neutrality. I've just been paying attention for 10 years, listening at conferences, listening to smart people say things, remember the context of how things got here, who's involved, what the various players are. And if you pay attention to something for long enough, you pay attention to it more than the vast majority of people, and compared to the vast majority of people, suddenly you're an expert. I still feel really weird if I call myself an expert, but, you know, compared to the other people who are actually making laws on this, yeah, I kind of am. So, you know, get over that. Just find something you're interested in, pay attention to it long enough, have opinions on it, always be ready to be wrong, because you're going to be wrong. That's okay. That's part of the argument. But just get involved, pay attention, find things to track over time, and you will be an expert whether you feel comfortable calling yourself that or not. Imposter syndrome is another thing we're probably going to talk about at some point.
Oh, yeah.
But you are a SME, so. A subject matter expert.
Oh.
A SME. You get to call yourself a SME. All right, someone else want to jump in on your path and skills?
Yeah, I'll jump in. Actually, it's a pretty similar story. So I came from industry, which is a very similar thing. It's that idea that now that I'm in public policy, knowing how it works inside the industry, because, you know, we're lobbying governments for change, we're trying to do legal change, but a lot of the work we do is lobbying private industry as well, because we want to see that the tools that they create are being done in a just manner. So having come from industry, I saw how that sausage was made and what the decisions look like when you're building a technology. What are the things that the product managers are going to care about? What is the internal politics and the bureaucracy, and how does all that work? And knowing all that and understanding how those decisions are made, coming over on the other side, is beneficial in multiple ways. On the one hand, it helps me on the outside know, like, which levers to press. Like, well, if we want the technology to be privacy protective, here are the people that will need to be convinced. Here are the arguments that these sort of people will find persuasive and that won't, which is something you really understand when you're in the middle of it and desperately trying to get any change made, and it's a good way to understand that. But it's great to have, you do get that one the subject matter expertise, right? Like, you know how this technology works, and knowing how exactly the technology works at a very deep level is something that is obviously useful in policy. But it's interesting. I feel like there is a large discussion that calls for, you want to have a Spock in the enterprise, right? You want to have the science officer who knows all the things about the technology. And it's interesting because that's not quite how people are. None of us are actually Vulcans, right? I don't know every piece of every bit of technology. I know a lot of things about a few very specific things. And I thought for a while that, like, oh, but that's ridiculous. Why are you asking me to talk about, like, electrical engineering? I'm a cryptographer. Gosh. Right. But it turns out, actually, no, the thing that Nathan was saying about Congress, it's like, the people in Congress making the laws may not be electrical engineers either, but, like, being a cryptographer is one step much closer to being able to understand the technology. And, like, you know, when I'm sitting there, I'm like, okay, I need to completely understand, like, all of Shannon and entropy, right? I can do that in a couple days, whereas, like, you know, someone without that technical baseline background, it's very valuable to have that going into the conversation.
And it's very true. There are too many Kirks in the kitchen and not enough Spocks.
I'm going to steal that line.
I stole that from Nick Lang, our Siege keynote this year. Sorry.
Nice. So the one thing I always recommend is, I always start this with an anecdote about my friend Jeremy. Jeremy is an ichthyologist. He studies the fishes, which he is convinced is the most boring thing in the universe to everyone else but him. And it had been on my bucket list for years to go to an aquarium with Jeremy, and I finally got to go to the Georgia Aquarium with him a couple of years ago, and he just blossomed. He was like, let me tell you about Asian carp. Asian carp are sons of bitches. And he would, like, but he just, his enthusiasm was so irrepressible when he was talking about these things. And I think one thing that is a genuine asset when you work in policy is you care about this. Like, it is, it's a double-edged sword, because you care about it, and it sometimes it keeps you up at night, and you care about it, and it's hard to turn off and stop working, and, like, you do have to do a lot of self-care. At the same time, you can sit down and talk to someone with the conviction that someone who is being paid to have that conviction most of the time can't fake. And being able to express that that enthusiasm can get you into some really wild places. You know, I've had to sit down and try to explain to staffers in Congress, I work a lot with fandom communities, and just say, like, so this copyright thing that you're proposing, it would outlaw gift making, and you have two 13-year-old daughters. Go home and tell me what they do in their spare time, and report back. And then, you know, trying to explain, there's this whole ecosystem of, and just connect it to people. And they're like, wow, I didn't think about that. And the way she's expressing it makes it seem like, even if I don't entirely grasp what she's talking about, it's probably a good thing that we want to preserve and maybe not make it legal. So just to be able to kind of walk in there, take your passion, connect the dots to what is going on, and to provide a new narrative to these problems can shift the discussion in some really kind of wild ways sometimes.
Can we pull the audience on GIF versus GIF?
Ah! No.
I honestly thought you said gift making. And I was like, what?
But I think Meredith brings up a great point. This has been part of the success of the Georgia Game Developers Association. As soon as you can connect an issue to a politician's children or grandchildren, the eyes suddenly light up, suddenly they're interested, and they become invested in it. And it has been amazing how successful we've had. Our initial conversations where we don't want our kids and grandkids playing this, to now they're trying to get their kids and grandkids into this and even into gaming more. So once... Sorry, go ahead, Amy.
No, I've very, very recently entered the academic sphere from the nonprofit sphere. It's a much more different world than I thought it was. But one of the words that I always knew and always kind of came up but has never come up as much as the word interdisciplinary. And policy really is, and when you're in the nonprofit sphere, you kind of take it for granted that policy is interdisciplinary because you work with everybody who comes from all of these different backgrounds. But in the academic space, you're really coming from like one area. And we're now working with the engineering school, and then I'm at the law school, and we're working with the business school, and we're trying to bring in all of these different backgrounds. So just a word on top of what everybody else says, you don't have to go to law school. You don't have to have gone to any, you don't have to have any specific academic background to go into the policy space. And in fact, you might be more valuable in the policy space if you don't have the background that you think you need to have to be able to contribute. So that is just kind of, and I went to law school, so maybe this is, sounds shallow, but I have never found that I have to work with lawyers. And some of the smartest people I know in the public policy space doing tech work aren't lawyers. So kind of a word about what background you don't need to go into the space. And just to real quick go back to accomplishments, I thought about this later. Nathan and I are both huge nerds, or we wouldn't be sitting here in front of you. And during our years at Access Now, we got to write a press release that was almost verbatim from a Star Wars trailer, a blog post using lyrics from Once More with Feeling, the Buffy musical episode. We got to integrate. So you can really be creative and try to get your messaging out, and I think that was a big win for us. Every time we did something where we could integrate those two worlds, it just the happiness that it produced from our end was so great. And so know that, like, policy doesn't have to be dry either. You can have wins that are purely like, I'm doing what I love and integrating all of these other things that I also love into the space.
All right, we're not going to whip out our geek credentials and try and show who's is more extensive. But I want to keep going with what Amy brought up here, and that is the teamwork aspect of it. That's one of the skills we hadn't addressed, which I personally consider probably the most important one in successful public policy. Yes, so we have a question.
This is a good example on teamwork. I'm a president of a Friends of a Library system in Jacksonville. And we always started out as an outlier group, because most of the time the library system wanted to close a library. So the neighborhood rose up and said no. So we were able to change the dialogue from they were trying to close us to, oh my gosh, this is a group, we can work together. So basically now we could go and talk on the behalf of the library to Congress, to our senators, whereas the librarians who are part of the system cannot say the things that we can. So it's like we work better on the outside. So one question I do have though is, how hard is it for you folk who are, paid to do this, of dealing with the constant other lobbyists who are trying to thwart your policy making? Because we face it too, because it's like money is tight, as they like to say.
So I wanted to jump in quick to introduce the other side before my co-panelists. Because I very recently on Twitter got called a destructive social climber. Those were the exact words. Because of who?
That was by an ally.
By an ally. Wow. By somebody I've worked very closely with in the past, because he disagreed with who my organizations I worked for accepted money from. Has never been able to point to one of my specific positions that he thought was corrupt or wrong. But had disagreements that I hadn't taken certain positions, which I haven't taken because I'm not an expert in that area, and I refuse to have an opinion about something I don't know enough about, which I think is actually the right thing to do. That is increasingly common, and I think actually you have the other, so you're working against these giant bodies that are incredibly well-oiled, well-functioning, well-funded machines. You're just trying to keep the lights on. You need money to do that, and we need clear conversations and rules, and to be able to talk openly about what that means and how to draw lines and how to stop eating our own body on the side where we're trying to do the right side of work, because increasingly our allies are turning against us because of this funding question as well, and it's creating a place where it's hard to get work done. And when I'm working on surveillance and somebody thinks I should be working on something else because that's what they care about, then all of a sudden, like, I'm a traitor when I'm trying to get, like, privacy reforms in the surveillance space. And I don't think that we should be in that. Like, you were taking it from both sides.
Yeah, the joke from Life of Brian, where they turn to the other reformed Judea People's Front and go, splitter, is very true. You can annoy it till you're the only person making your screams anymore. So, yeah, teamwork is crucial to this. And you talk about the other side. In my line, I don't see another side, and I really try to maintain this focus even when there's very clear binary 0-1 decision on a bill. I can try my best to work with everybody out there. Oh, let me also give a round of applause for librarians who became our first line of freedom defense in the past decade. So glad to see the true warriors on the front line. But being able to work with people, so I have my government appointees. One is from a very progressive Democratic county commissioner or CEO, and on the other side from a very conservative Republican governor. So I do see a great deal of benefit in crossing the streams to get things accomplished. And I'm very proud that most of what I do ends up with great bipartisan support. And I think we have a lot more opportunities than we think we do in getting these groups to work together. And we do. Those are some amazing victories. But it really is that teamwork side. How do you build a coalition? Coalition is teamwork at its most essential focus. How can you bring in 10 groups to become a Goliath instead of a David and become the juggernaut to get things done? I like to point to game development, actually, for my skills on this, where you think it's developing games in the basement. It's very much about team management, bringing together a good team, working with marketing, working with a publisher, working with distributors, getting in front of the press, and all on a very tight time constraints. These sort of team skills are absolutely crucial in the public policy world. Legislation pops up like that. You're either fighting to stop something bad or to implement something good, and you are moving as fast as you can as that fire hose is shooting you forward. And the only way you can succeed is by bringing in more of you. You can't just be that one person. It has to be a group of you to succeed on anything. So we'd love to talk about more of the teamwork and continue addressing the question of how do you deal with that other side.
Yeah, so I think the answer to this is very different in different areas of policy. I have the benefit of my org works on both telecom policy and intellectual property policy. Telecom policy, by and large, it's a relatively small number of people who all, even on the opposite side, they all respect each other and they generally all get along. Someone who will remain nameless on Twitter tried to go after my old boss, Gigi Sohn, and people who spend their entire day job disagreeing with her publicly leapt into her defense, and they're like, you do not call her that. And that's, you know, there is sort of a, you know, I don't want to call it fraternal necessarily, but there's a respect, I think, that is endemic to a lot of the people who do this for a living on the telecom side. Then there's the intellectual property side, which that same person who leapt in to defend my former boss once referred to as the Vietnam of public policy, and I think is probably accurate. That can get a lot more personal very quickly. And, you know, I can't speak for any other fields, but I suspect that that's a big spectrum that runs across, you know, what you're dealing with. It can get very ugly on IP policy, especially copyright, because copyright impacts a lot of small musicians for whom this is a very existential question. So I've had friends who have been doxxed for working on copyright policy. I've had folks who, my block list grew very, very large on Twitter because there are some people who are pretty heavily followed and pretty well respected in the field who spend their entire, you know, Twitter presence basically threatening other people. Part of that is, you know, again, the folks who are inside the Beltway, with some notable exceptions, tend to be more collegial.
The Beltway is DC.
Yeah. That was a very Beltway thing of me to say. No, people who work and live and, you know, breathe the DC life, you know, tend to realize that everyone's a repeat player. You're going to run into the same people over and over again. You really, in theory, you can't get super far by pissing everyone off. In practice, and you know, there are all kinds of stupid mind games that people will play with each other, and that's those kinds of things are when you need a team to back you up on it. So, classic example: I had someone who is very, very, very high up in the entertainment industry who was disagreeing with our position on a bill, who did the extremely obnoxious DC, who was an older white man, who did the extremely obnoxious DC thing of calling my CEO, who is also an older white man, and saying, oh, we need to hash this out, you know, head of org to head of org over a steak lunch at the Palm, which is like down the street from us, because clearly you don't know what your subordinates are saying. To which my boss, God bless him, said, yeah, I don't know anything about this shit. You're going to have to deal with Meredith directly. I'll send her to the lunch. At which point he canceled the lunch. But I really wanted to roll up into the Palm, like wearing this, which is what I wear every day. Just like put my shoes on the table and pull a Blues Brothers. But that's when you need people to back you up and just say, like, no, you are not flying over the head of the subject matter expert in my office. And also, thank God, my boss is like, I really don't want to know anything about music licensing. Like, don't tell me. Don't get me involved. So you need to have people who will back you up on this stuff. And that's where, you know, finding your organization, building a rapport with them, having a really good culture within the office of mutual respect and not putting up with shit, messing with your coworkers is a big deal.
Let's talk about the various spectrums then of public policy. If one of you wants to jump in on it some more.
I think there's a question.
Ah.
Yes. How do you fight to preserve freedoms when the CISCOT News says that these freedoms are it's your fault, that you're the cause of all the society ills, but to preserve your freedoms, you must fight against public pressure.
That's a good point. How do you fight for these when you're being vilified? Facebook.
You stop. Nathan.
I do have a bit of an answer to that. I started in politics, and there's a rule of thumb in politics that you never argue with an individual. There's just no point to it. You need thousands of people to vote for you. There's no benefit to spending a lot of time arguing with one person. Best case scenario, I get your vote, but I just wasted a lot of time. So you deal with mass numbers. You deal with advertising at a high level because I know 80% of this side of the room is going to vote, so I'm talking to 80% of these people. I don't want to talk to them because I don't want to waste my time on people who don't agree with me. I want to encourage you to go vote. It's kind of the opposite when you're dealing with policy. You don't care about big numbers, but you care about individuals who matter. You care about this person is the key person on this committee, I need to swing their vote. This person is the chairman of the FTC or the FCC who makes this decision, I need to convince their staff. You deal a lot with the individuals. There's also a little bit of a flame war that goes on because to get people to care about your issues, there needs to be like a level of tension of awareness about it. If I go into an office and I start talking about something that no one's ever heard of, they're just not gonna care. But if I go into an office and talk about something that's in the media, in society, people are talking about is active on social media, then at least you have some like basis to get in. It's interesting, maybe my constituents are in this, maybe I should be a leader. So kind of ignore the personal attacks to the extent that you're able to. They are sort of necessary for this policy battle to take place, for people to argue and people to be passionate. Not the insults, definitely not that part of it, but the passion and the argument are necessary for things to be on the radar of policy issues. But if somebody's being mean to you as an individual, there's really no upside to engaging back, unless they're a member of Congress, and which that's becoming increasingly common and very scary.
I always say I've hit the trifecta. When I've gone into a day on Twitter and somebody's called me a CIA operative, a privacy and human rights absolutist, and a corporate shill.
All at once.
All in one. Mm. Like, there are days when I get all three. I almost always get one of the three in a day, but there are days when I get all three. And if that many sides of the argument are disagreeing with you, I'd like to say you're probably doing it right. Because you're being true to what you think is the right position, regardless of what the people on any side of the argument believe. And it's really hard sometimes, because again, sometimes those people are the people who are your allies, who think that you've taken the wrong position. Sometimes they're people with massive followings on the other side who are going to send all sorts of hate and vitriol and threats your way. And in the internet space, that can be overwhelming. I've seen people driven off, driven out of policy because of the threats that they receive, which is really sad because those people were incredibly intelligent people who had a lot to give to this space. And so the best I can say is follow what you think is the right thing and know that people on every side are going to disagree with you at different points in time. But I respect the people who leave the space because they can't deal with it. It can get really, really bad, and I've seen it get really bad for people. And that's a legitimate choice, especially in vulnerable people from vulnerable communities.
And there is the ability to shift the debate, and I've seen this happen dramatically. So back in the early aughts, I was on the board of Georgia Normal, and cannabis reform was a big issue then. But the one thing we would always hear from legislators was, none of my constituents are contacting me about this. So that was the first thing that had to change, was getting constituents, reaching out to them. And that changed over time. I've had to do this with the Game Developers Association as well, where we needed to do a big grassroots campaign back in 2012. Politicians, again, saying, none of my constituents care about the game industry. So not only did we get people in the Atlanta area working in the field writing, but we also got parents out in Villa Rica and Jonesville and all throughout Georgia writing in because their kids wanted to work in game development. If you don't have an industry here, those kids are going to California.
So relevant story on that. Sometimes they just lie. Sometimes they say my constituents don't call me about this. 2 years ago, we were here and we set up, Amy and Meredith and I, we set up a phone over by our booth over there, and we had people call in. Isaacson is the senator from Georgia?
Not for long.
But we before we came down here, we went and met with the staff, and they gave us that, and they're like, no one calls us from this. We don't get any calls from our constituents. So we came down here, had 200 people call Senator Isaacson's office, went back the next week, they said, no, we have not heard from a single constituent. Like, that's a damn lie. Sometimes they mean funders, too, but that's where the individual matters of what is going to convince this person. Is it going to be 1,000 phone calls, or is it the right 2 phone calls from the right constituents?
Yeah, we're not going to have time to get into the local versus state versus federal arguments, but it is easier to make that fight on local and state levels. More questions?
The other thing I just wanted to flag real quick, because this is a part of the conversation that I think it's lost a lot, which is in tech policy, a lot of the groups that are most directly affected by changes in tech policy are already marginalized communities. So I was on a panel last night about SESTA FOSTA, and how it's impacted sex workers. These are communities that, for all number of reasons, do not feel comfortable being advocates in a public sense. And so you run into situations where, you know, we've worked on bills where we're looking at this and going, this could impact people, you know, this could impact, you know, immigrant communities of you know, undocumented migrants. We could talk about sex workers, and you know, the response, the canned response when they don't kind of want to listen to the argument is, well, we're going to need to hear it from them. And it's like, well, you're probably not going to, barring some truly heroic individuals who are ready to roll up into your office on the hill.
There are organizations who do,
and there absolutely are.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, this speaks to another, I think, sort of endemic problem in DC, and I'm going to say this is DC specific because that's what I work with. Like, organizing with those groups is very difficult, and finding people who, so like Jinx Lierre, who, you know, was the subject of the greatest reason.com headline ever written, which is Jinx the anarchist sex worker goes to Washington. You know, she's phenomenal. She has no problem getting up here and being like, hi, I'm a sex worker and this bill is fucked up. But I think that there are fewer necessarily among those communities for whole numbers of reasons. And so you do end up in a problem where, you know, it's very easy to ignore, I think, for lawmakers who really just genuinely don't want to deal with the problem. They'll be like, oh, this doesn't impact anyone because I'm not hearing. It's like, well, no, you do, but you have to consider the context from which those people are going to be speaking.
Okay, more questions.
Yeah, hi. I work in open source mapping technology, and I think the last couple of years, the rug has really been pulled out under our feet as federal databases that we've relied on for over half a century have just disappeared overnight. And we're trying to figure out ways that private enterprise can work better with these open data portals to protect them, because so much of work is reliant on NOAA data, USDA data, USGS, et cetera. And the fear of losing it overnight can be catastrophic for so many different things in what I do and so many others do. So what kind of work can we do towards that together?
There. God, I'm going to forget the name. I'm going to forget both the name of the group and the name of the law. But there was a law passed by the Open Net Government Coalition. Hudson Hollister used to be the executive director. I'm happy to talk to you after, but there are some groups that are trying to push for this and trying to get more government data, both open and in a machine-readable format, because it's amazing how much of it isn't. So I'm happy to talk through that specific issue, because I think that there are people trying to do that work. And I think connecting it also down to the state level, I don't know which level you're working at, but it's going to be really important as well, because you need those links. But they're trying to make it happen. A law was passed recently, and so we might see some improvements in that space, but I think getting the government into this century on those issues is going to be a long road.
I'll also say, probably not fully appropriate for your project, but filing FOIA requests is a great citizen activity. You got to wait like a year, but is still fun. I've filed a bunch of those, and you're always surprised with what you get.
And I also think a lot more of these regulatory framework changes are going to end up in court. And that, again, is a great place for coalition. You need the funding for good lawyers. You need to be able to provide briefs for each other. You need to have those friends of providing it. And that's another place where just reaching out to anyone impacted becomes of value. Okay, next question.
So I actually work in local government near here, but we get to write some policy, but mostly I'm one of the poor schmucks who has to put it in place and actually make it happen when people make decisions without asking us. And one of the things, like Senator Isaacson saying, nobody's actually called on that, is it is amazing how much people will not show up if they think something's good. So you have to, we've had entire policies changed because 10 people from one part of the area came in and said, oh no, I don't want that. And then you talk to constituents later who were like, oh no, that was really good. Why didn't that pass? Because nobody who liked it, who approved of it, nobody ever came out and spoke. And, as someone who works locally, you can make massive changes just by showing up to a Tuesday night meeting. Mm-hmm. And, getting it out there because your elected officials are pilots or grandmas or people that have never worked in the space and they have no idea how to run anything. And so when people come in and they have a very good reasoned background, you can completely get it changed in that moment.
And let me be clear, as much as we despise lobbyists and we love the Warren bill to keep congresspeople from becoming lobbyists, we are all lobbyists. We are all citizen lobbyists and should consider ourselves as such. We don't need to register with the state or federal government as such. But Planned Parenthood used to do every year their citizen lobbyist training, taking people down to the Gold Dome here in Georgia, walking them through all the offices, making sure they knew how it all worked. We are all citizen lobbyists. That's on the city level. That's on the county level. That's on the state level. That's on the federal level. And we can all be active there.
And it's fun. Like, if you haven't been, I highly recommend going to your local city council meeting, right? You look at federal politics, you're like, oh, I'm just one person and it's such a big machine. But this is like, the few blocks around your house, right? Like, you can make a serious difference and feel the impact of your change, and that feels really good.
Anyone here live in Tucker or DeKalb, I'll take you on out to meet your county commissioners and city council people, so.
And a plug for EFF, they do a ton of work over in San Francisco and Oakland on the local level, and they've gotten major changes with international recognition. Like, you guys do great work at that level.
And it's great because, like, it's a level that's small enough that we can actually make that change by having a few people who live in these neighborhoods. Like, we live in San Francisco, we live in Oakland, right? It matters to us on our daily basis. So we want to see these policies implemented everywhere. And how are we supposed to know exactly what's going to work if we don't do it at our local level first? So.
All right, one more question and then we'll have closing statements.
Cool, I have the mic. I want to ask a question about the Cloud Act. Really, it's a broad question. I work for big tech, and we're super concerned about the Cloud Act, not just privacy in general, but the humanitarian concerns that go with it, as well as the fact that it's sitting or has come out of the Judiciary Committee instead of the committee in the House that handles technology. So I just kind of want to get a feel for the panel, what y'all think of that and what y'all are doing or not doing to help out with that.
So I spent a lot of the last year working on that, and now I work for a company, so I don't get to say anything. So,
so just, I will summarize the Cloud Act, because it's pretty wonky for people in the room, and I'll do it fast. Cloud Act, there's a mechanism called the Mutual Legal Assistance Treaty, where if one law enforcement bureau, say located in England, needs to get evidence of a crime, and the evidence is located in the United States, they have to go through this mutual legal assistance treaty process to make sure they're respecting the laws of both their local government and the US government. That used to be a very rarely used process, but in the technical age where companies hold all of their information in the US and there's a lot of potential evidence for crimes in that information, it's become used a lot and mostly directed at our country. The Cloud Act was an opportunity to say that governments in other countries can create agreements with the US wherein they can come directly to law enforcement or to companies in the US to request data that's held here. So rather than going through this longer process, they can go straight to the company, data's held in the US, and request that data. The problem that we saw was they didn't require ample human rights protections from the government that is going to enter into the agreement with the United States. So, for example, the UK is, the reason I use England, one of the first governments that people think will have one of these agreements under the Cloud Act. So the UK law enforcement could both directly request information from companies here as well as potentially wiretap people in the US directly without going through our system. The UK's surveillance laws make the US's surveillance laws look really, really good. They're incredibly open and allow for a lot of abuse, very little transparency. The Investigatory Powers Act was passed fairly recently and allows mass hacking of devices, as well as targeted hacking, backdoors and encryption. So it's good that we are able to route around those processes because there are hyper-local crimes where you want people to be able to get evidence of those crimes really quickly. And that evidence may be held here. And when somebody in a small English village is murdered by somebody else in a small English village, and the evidence of that is located in the U.S., they shouldn't take a year to get that information. But this was probably not the right mechanism to solve that problem.
All right. We've got two more minutes. So for everyone out here on the panel, go ahead and tell them how they can get involved in public policy through your organization or with another organization you'd like them to be involved with. Anyone want to start?
Well, the most important thing I think you can do is to rate us in the DragonCon app.
Yay!
I have to convince my employer to let me come back next year, and this will help. So that's my get involved speech.
My organization's a little bit weird because we're not a membership-driven organization. We operate off of grants. But what we do is we have a blog, we have a mailing list, we have, call your representative actions when there are pieces of legislation coming up, follow us on Twitter, and just get passionate about this stuff. Go talk at the local level. Go engage at a grassroots level.
I'll say in the cybersecurity space here in Georgia, we have a master's program at Georgia Tech for people that want to do cybersecurity, but it's also an online program, so you can be anywhere and take it. That said, if you're already involved in cybersecurity, that's my space. There's a group called We Are the Cavalry associated with B-Sides, and I'll just highlight them. So attend your local B-Sides if you do cyber.
There are many ways to get involved with
Yay.
UFF. We are a member-driven organization. That means things on every single level. Okay, at the highest level, right? If you don't have a lot of time, well, we take cash dollars and other types of dollars as well. You can come by our booth if you want to become a member. We are able to do this work because of support of members like you. If you want to do next level above that, you can join our mailing list, and when we need everybody to go send letters to the senator, we don't always have a phone box, you can walk up into the phone box and call your senator, but you can do that using your cellular devices as well. And when we want you to do that for a specific bill, we will email you and let you know when the time is right. If you want to do a level above that, we have the Electronic Frontier Alliance. If you are here in Georgia, you should probably go talk to Scott about that one. If you are located somewhere else, there is probably an organization local to your area that organizes things at the local and federal level for you. Here's the person I was just volunteering that you should go talk to if you want to get involved with your Georgia EF group.
I assume a lot of you want a job, so real quick on that, because you probably want to get paid also. Look at the state and local level. If an organization that does what you want to do doesn't exist, think about starting one. There are a lot of state local foundations within all the states. Look up where you might be able to get money. Some of that can be difficult. I'm not going to say it's going to be easy, but sometimes it's a harder road. And be willing to move. And I say this as somebody who just moved across the country. There are a lot of needs around the world and around the country, and maybe you don't have that freedom. But if you do have that freedom, you might be able to make a difference in a smaller community. A lot of people want to go to D.C. I wouldn't recommend that right now, but I also just left D.C., so I'm a little bit biased. There are opportunities. There are people giving money. Just keep an eye out for them and follow the people who might have job openings, because they're looking for people at all different levels a lot of the time.
We have job openings. It's us.
Community is really important. Follow people on Twitter. Follow policy experts on Twitter. A lot of times people post job threads where we all know all the organizations that are hiring, but none of us are looking for work right now. So a lot of times people will retweet that. Twitter is really great for policy professionals. Use the mute button liberally. dangerous waters ahead, but it's also a really good resource.
And do support your allies on Twitter. We're having a Me Too moment in the game industry right now, so we are making sure that voices are being promoted and being heard throughout. Everyone in the game industry is making sure they're part of amplifying the noise, the sound on this one. So I'm with the Georgia Game Developers, ggda.org, as simple as could be. The Siege Convention is siegecon.net. Love to have you out there. We do interact with politicians on a regular basis. It's very interesting that I can walk in and talk to almost any legislator down at the Gold Dome, Lieutenant Governor, sometimes the governor, et cetera, and it is valuable to be able to have them hear you on any of the issues you care about. And if you were interested in the hyperlocal side, Tucker or DeKalb, I'll hang out and chat about that too. So thank you all. Rate us, and congratulations once more. Great EFF track.